As you know, the world, as so often seems, is going to hell in a handbasket. And we know from religious traditions that the truth is what we see. We represent a transformative tradition, each of the major religions. We seem to agree on basics, but somehow it gets lost in translation. And Unitarianism, I think, stands with a very heavy emphasis on an irrational approach, a rational approach to religion. And, you know, it doesn't seem to be overly popular. Now, maybe you can work on some new angles. I wish you well on that. And I think people of goodwill should hope that any religion can concentrate on the basics that gave it its formation and pray also that these basics don't get lost in translation. I haven't heard that that's a problem with Unitarianism, that things get lost in translation. Well, I was thinking this morning about people that help remind us where we've come from and where we're going. And I think I referred to one of my favorite theologians the last time, and that was George Carlin. Now, George Carlin has a way of really concentrating on words and the meaning of words. This thing, I feel like somebody's got a fist in it. You changed microphones, didn't you? Wasn't it something else before? Anyway. He talks about words and how words are important, and when you deviate from words, then you lose the central focus of what that word meant. Did you like that? I just think of one where he talks about shell shock from World War I. You can almost feel what that meant. Well, that's gone through permutations until now it's something, something, something syndrome. What's it called? Any of you familiar with Oh, it sounds so antiseptic. We make everything antiseptic. So George Carlin talks about the fact, he gets everybody mad at him. He gets environmentalists mad at him. He doesn't think the world's going to change. He thinks, how much nerve does it take to believe we are going to alter the earth? I mean, that's just sheer stupidity. Human beings are going to change the earth. Says maybe our whole point here is to leave something behind that nature could not produce on its own. Plastic, for instance. A million years from now, when we're gone, covered over by the dust of antiquity, there will be human bones and plastic. And that's what we were here to do. Nature could not do it on its own, so it's earth and plastic. And that's why we were here. Well, it doesn't exactly jive with an inconvenient truth, but it's, you know, he gets you to think. And he will get everybody mad, as I said, so he has the idea of going into a National Organization for Women's office in New York. Just walking right in there and saying to whoever he meets first, which one of you cupcakes wants to come home with me and make dinner? Well, I'm not sure I would try that. One of his other things is about stuff. He talks about the fact that we Americans like to accumulate stuff. And we get our identity from stuff. All the stuff that we have over the years that we take such pride at hoarding, saving, replicating, and putting in a special place. Stuff. And you know that. You've all moved from a bigger house to a little house. What do you do with your stuff? And it's almost painful separating yourself from your stuff. Well, I moved a year ago after living 18 years in Anaheim. And I didn't think I had a big place. I didn't. It's maybe, what is it, 1,100 square feet, 1,200? But I had a lot of stuff. But it was partly a joy. And it's still going on because there are boxes that have not yet been opened. I like to take time with my stuff. So I was opening up one box, and lo and behold, I found in my stuff a promotion from Brown Military Academy in 1958. Brown Military Academy was in Pacific Beach, then they moved to Glendora and closed entirely in 67. I guess during the height of the Vietnam War, military academies had problems. Anyway, so here I am, advanced to cadet corporal when I was in third grade. This is part of my stuff. You didn't know I had a military background, did you? I got up every morning in Coronado and took the ferry boat across the bay, got picked up in a van, and this little uniform, a little kid, that's my side. I used to actually drive the ferry boat. I didn't believe it really was drivable. I thought it was on rails. So one time I just turned the wheel, and you might as well have thought it was a Titanic. Well, that's part of my stuff. Also, last week I went to a family reunion for my stepmother in Whittier, and it was 115 degrees. And the hotel was near Whittier College, where I graduated, and I knew particularly that the dorm I lived in as a freshman was near the hotel, so I go out looking for it, and it's a block, across the street from my hotel, the college dorm. And so I wandered in there, and I hadn't been there in 38 or 39 years. And so maybe that's also what stuff does. Stuff is accumulated memories. And memories can either empower or sabotage or pull you down. And each one of us have, as part of our stuff, those kinds of memories. Well, I think part of the stuff we also look at is the stuff that makes us whole or human. And going through the stuff in our lives, we realize that our values get called into question when we go through things. We survey where we've come from. How far have we come? Have we made progress, or are we going backwards? And that's an innately intrinsic human thing to do that basically is good. Although so often, if you look at our faces, when we look at ourselves in the mirror, it looks like we're not having a great time doing it. Our stuff weighs us down, doesn't it? We often are not liberated by our stuff. We worry about it. It causes us to atrophy or to worry or to stop, or for fear that we're going to make mistakes in the future, we just don't do anything. Now, I don't think that's true of anyone here. And you know how I can tell? I can look at your faces. You look basically happy, forward-looking, and hopeful, as opposed to many other people that gather in churches or religious places. In fact, now that I think about it, religion has a lot of stuff. Every so often, I used to watch the movie Brother, Son, Sister, Moon, the Franco Zeffirelli film about the life of St. Francis. Any of you familiar with it? Now, I could ask Gail whether, you know, this is probably accurate, and she would completely destroy it, so I'm not going to ask her. You know, these historians. They can ruin anything. You ever notice that? All of your stuff, your pet ideas, you go to a scholar, and before you know it, it's all silly putty on the floor. So I'm not going to do that. She can have rebuttal time later. Anyway, I see this film every 5 or 6 years, and I see something new, and I'm either really transfixed by it. This last time I saw it, 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was practically in tears. And I'm trying to figure out, the film has not changed. I don't think they added anything, so it's me. Oh, what is it? The sheer passion and willingness of St. Francis to shed all of his stuff for what he believed in. How could someone in Coronado do that? Was he reaching beyond the celluloid? Even with that hokey music by Donovan. The sheer ability to see perspective, and Zeffirelli does a masterful job in this film contrasting the poverty of St. Francis with his feet. You see his feet a lot, and his face, over against the pomposity and the grandeur of Italian cities and finally the Vatican. And it has a fascinating encounter between Pope Innocent III at the height of the papacy, with the huge reception hall, and the poverty of St. Francis tramping in with his colleagues in torn and dirty clothes. Alec Guinness, before Obi-Wan Kenobi days, plays Pope Innocent III. And you can see in the contrast, the poverty and the grandeur, that Innocent III is also captured by the simplicity of Francis, until Innocent gets off his throne, goes down, and gets on the ground and kisses Francis' feet. Now, you're going to tell me that probably didn't happen, aren't you? I can just see it. Go ahead, destroy it! Well, anyway, of course, the papal crowd around him is nervous until one really savvy diplomat says, the Holy Father knows what he's doing. He's going to help the masses come back to church. Maybe that was what he was doing. Anyway, this film did something to me, and it made me nervous. Is there something going on inside me? I don't know. It's still too early. I'll let you know next year. But anyway, the religious stuff that we have is really depressing these days, because religions, as I mentioned, are designed to transform and change people. But instead, it seems like things get lost in translation. We forget the basics, or somehow we get caught up in the reality of the difficulty of human life and passions. Instead of resulting in a wonderful thing like what St. Francis did, we seem to get judgmental. We divide the world. We have us and them. We're willing to kill. Not you, of course. I don't think Unitarians have ever killed anybody. What's wrong with you people? You've never burned anyone at the stake? Makes me nervous if people aren't willing to cross that line. Of course, what would happen if Unitarians got in control? What if we had a Unitarian president? A Unitarian Congress? Oh, you know what? Maybe you don't want that. That's when the trouble begins, when you get in power. That's kind of causing you to think there, isn't it? The Unitarian candidate. Yeah, what would Rohrabacher do with that one? Is he your congressman here?
Oh, God.
Oh, God? Is that a prayer? I didn't know you had prayers here. Some of you may be familiar with Dietrich Bonhoeffer. This is sort of a summer stream of consciousness sermon, in case you hadn't quite figured it out yet. It must be the Coronado lifestyle. Anyway, a favorite theologian of mine, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a German pastor during World War II and was executed by the Nazis for being part of a plot to assassinate Hitler. Not the normal thing a pastor gets involved in. And Bonhoeffer really didn't quite know how he could justify this with religious background. But finally he said, when a Christian sees the demonic taking over, he or she has to do anything to put a spoke in the wheel to try to stop it. And whether you do it as a Christian or a world citizen or even a good German, you have to do it. Well, we still haven't figured out, and the German churches today still haven't figured out, whether Bonhoeffer is a political martyr or a religious martyr. But anyway, some of his writings, and if you're doing some summer reading, you might want to get a hold of his letters and papers from prison, which were written between the time that he was arrested by the Nazis, who had a suspicion he was up to something, and the point they had actual proof, which was just weeks before the end of the war and Hitler personally ordered Bonhoeffer's execution. In these writings, where he's not worrying about posterity, reminds me of the writings of St. Paul, but now had become almost like a religious canon. Bonhoeffer talks about the sheer, complete failure of religion in Germany, Christianity in particular. And he says somehow things have got to change. And he talks about that human beings need to grow up and maybe put away childish ideas of God. God as the Deus ex machina. There's your word for it. Use that in your next cocktail party. The Deus ex machina. The God that comes down and fixes things. The God that keeps us infantile. That keeps us little. That keeps us servile. And Bonhoeffer talks about the fact that God wants us to grow up and to stand up and to mature. And maybe that means putting away all of the accoutrements of religion which keep us so paralyzed from being who we were destined to become. See, it's interesting for a pastor to talk this way. And he goes on at some length about it. Well, I think that when you have a crisis and you have to survey all your values and what's going on in the world, that can be a very creative time. When you're willing to let go of the presuppositions that you've had about what makes true religion true, or what makes you a human being, what is it that is going on inside you where you have to survey the landscape, as Bonhoeffer did, and be able to say, I have to keep this, I have to jettison that. In other words, getting rid of stuff. Just about as difficult, maybe more difficult, when you downsize. And there are different ways of downsizing. I think the future is going to be very difficult, because the world has finally reached the place, maybe as Bonhoeffer foretold, where we're coming of age. We're like teenagers that are now getting into their late teens, and we begin to realize that life means business. Life is impacting us. We can't keep going back. We can't going back like hide and go seek, go back and find base and say ollie ollie in free. Can't do that anymore. You've grown up. Humanity is growing up. And religion is at the place where, if it's not going to help us do that, the traditional religions, then maybe we have to collectively, humanity, have to say, it's time to move on. You heard me in my sermon a year or two ago talk about moving beyond Aristotle. Aristotle, whose mindset has really determined what we think about so much in science and Western civilization. And gender roles. Gender roles were determined largely by Greek Neoplatonic philosophy, largely going back to Aristotle. Women, you wonder why you don't get paid the same as men? Thank you, Aristotle. He believed that in the gestation period that females did not receive a soul as soon as the male did. I don't know how he knew this. I don't know what microscope he looked under. It just seems self-evident. Be careful of self-evident truth. I don't care whether it's Jefferson or anyone. Demand proof. Anyway, that's where... it's not from the Bible. Listen, the Bible is patriarchal, but it also plays havoc and makes fun of patriarchy. You know that. You've read the Old Testament. You've got female characters that just love to lampoon the men. Well, Aristotle never had anybody that lampooned him, and we're still paying the consequences. More stuff to get rid of. I think that should be your angle in the new universalist Unitarian marketing strategy. Stuff to get rid of! It's time to move on! And now that I've played havoc with my notes and have moved on, let me suggest that when you have times of solitude, and I hope, and I know you do, turn off your stuff. Go into a quiet place. Turn off the radio, turn off the iPod, turn off the stereo, turn off the TV. And listen, I think you are the authority. Each of us is an authority, author, the author of, the authority of our stuff. And we need at times to just listen to ourselves. Americans are so obsessed with going somewhere, shopping somewhere, turning on noise. We need solitude. We need to listen. And discover again what are the authentic texts that you follow. You are a textual authority, and you are a text. You are a sacred religious text that is in need of translation, just like they do with the Bible. And sometimes the Bible is difficult to translate, because from the Greek or the Hebrew, you have to figure out, do you translate it literally, woodenly? Do you kind of get the flow of the language? Do you take some poetic license to try to get across the meaning, even if that isn't exactly what it says? And that's why there are different translations. Well, the same is true for each of us. We are religious texts, unusual and unique, not to be repeated ever again. Look around at each other. All of these texts that are in the room together today. Some a bit different than other texts. Some unique, some just downright eccentric. But who wants to be in the center anyway? We all want to be outside the center. That's another thing. Americans are so crazy. They want to be different, they want to be unique, and we all look the same. Just go down to the, what's that mall in Orange, I've forgotten, the one all the teenagers go to, the Block. Just look at that. You will see uniformity. They walk out of the stores looking uniform, but they want to be an individual. Anyway, we are the custodian of our texts, and they are rich. brimful of meaning. But for the most part, the culture tells you, tells me, do not look at your text. Lose your text. Look at all of this. You can fill in the word. I've got to be careful of the words I use here. I know you're Unitarians, but there are limits. The plethora of decoys that are out there. How is that? Was that acceptable? The plethora of decoys. Distractions. Stuff. And you have to be able to withdraw from that to a degree. We can't all withdraw. The American economy would collapse. You realize we're in a problem here. If a movement starts in this country that really does what St. Francis did, and you start to withdraw, the system's going to know it and recognize it and do something about it. Unitarians, for instance, could be dangerous. Do you want to do that? I'm not so sure. I think it's nice just to kind of be gentle, well-meaning, moderate in your approach. Because if you do more than that, if you confront the ugliness of the system and its undercurrents of ugly religion, then you will get noticed. And if you get noticed, then somebody's going to do something about it. I think Unitarians now have all of the atmospheric suggestions, but they're not really getting to the place of being a threat. Do you want that? Anyway, during the summer, and I'm going to close because in my stream of consciousness, I can see, because Gail wants her rebuttal, but she'll have to do it in her own time. Did that thing with Innocent III really happen? Did he get off and kiss his feet? Gail does not know, so we're getting out of here. We're all lucky. And she's going to research it and let me know. Probably the custodians of Orthodoxy didn't let that get out. It's Zeffirelli's imagination. But you know, maybe it could have happened. Francis is an example of what happens when you spend time by yourself. And you think. And that scene where he takes all of his clothes off in the public square in Assisi and hands them to his parents, his father, and says, I'm no longer your child. And he walks out and starts what becomes the Franciscan order. Wow. That could be Unitarianism. Anyway, I wish you well in your continued odyssey to discover what stuff to keep and what stuff to get rid of. And to close with the words of Innocent III, only later when he was Obi-Wan Kenobi, may the Force be with you.